It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. An iconic Wisconsin boot manufacturer was named a finalist in this year's Coolest Thing Made in Wisconsin contest, with more than 100 products nominated this year, representing dozens of manufacturing sectors. The contest is put on by Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce. We explore the Thoroughgood brand and the economics of a boot company, and you can join in. Call in with a question, share your comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Jeff Burns is president of Merrill headquartered Weinbrenner Shoe Company. Jeff, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Good morning. Thoroughgood being Weinbrenner's brand of work boots. Can you describe what the standard Thoroughgood boot looks like and feels like?
Well, we're primarily a work boot company, and it's a classic welted product that has been, you know, an iconic look for, you know, over 100 years.
Mm-hmm. How cool are these boots? Give us on a scale here. How cool do you think they are?
Well, I'm a little biased, but I think they're very cool, but we get comments from all over the world that you know, people not only use these boots to work in, but they're working after work. They're using them to go out to restaurants. And we've had people say that they actually have been married in them. So, and not only it's a great look for a work boot, but it's a great look for a lifestyle boot.
What is the brand value in being made in Wisconsin? What does that value have?
Well, you know, there's not many footwear companies left in the United States. You know, 30 years ago, there were quite a few shoe companies in the United States. And with the onslaught of imported product, a lot of shoe companies went out of business. And, you know, we've been making shoes in the state of Wisconsin for 132 years. And, you know, that's important. But unless the boot is really quality and a good boot, made in USA doesn't mean as much. But, you know, when you put the best boot in the world, that we think we do make the best boot in the world, then people can wear it with pride, saying that they're wearing a boot made in the USA.
Jeff, what about materials? Can you get reasonable access to your raw materials that go in these boots and the supply chains that, you know, you mentioned? It would seem that it would be difficult if most the shoes on our feet aren't made here.
Well, that has been a little bit of a challenge. You know, like you said, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, when there was a lot of shoe companies in the country, there was a lot of component manufacturers in the country. And now that a lot of the shoe manufacturers are gone, the component manufacturers are gone. But we source the finest materials from all over the world. And then we make them here in Wisconsin. So if we feel like, say, eyelets are, you know, the better quality is out of Italy, we'll source them out of Italy. So we demand USA hide. So all of our leather is made in America because, quite frankly, the USA leather is the finest in the world. So we use a lot of USA hides, but, you know, we source, again, the finest components from all over the world.
What about steel in steel toes? Where do you find that?
Well, again, like you said, there's not a whole lot of manufacturers making steel toes, but we do find there are a couple of manufacturers left in the United States making steel toes. And there's also a move to go to a composite safety toe. So we're actually using a lot of composite safety toes, and there's a couple of manufacturers in the United States that make those also.
How do you do that? How do you test and make these breakthroughs in new design and technology in your boots and know that you can put them out there at the end of the day on sale to consumers? Because it's really make or break if they don't work for them.
Well, there are standards that we have to comply with, OSHA standards and you know, safety standards. But the thing that makes us you know, a little unique is that a lot of companies, footwear companies out there now, have designers that can draw pretty pictures. And we've got designers that can draw pretty pictures, too. We've also got shoemakers that know how to make a shoe. So, you know, you've got people that can, you know, come up with a nice concept. But then we've got the people that actually know how to make the shoe.
Wow, it's like artisans who have the technological know-how to put the footwear together.
There's no question. I mean, it takes 130 steps to make one of our boots. And if we fall down in any of those steps, you know, we could have an issue with the boot. So there are a lot of things have to happen. A lot of things have to come together to make, again, what we think is the finest boot in the world. And you're right. We have craftsmen. We not just have, you know, people that are, you know, putting a bolt on here, a bolt on there. And we've got people that actually are craftsmen and then take great pride in making our boots.
Talking with Jeff Burns, president of Weinbrenner Shoe Company, about the Thorogood work boots. You can join in with your questions and comments along the way, 800-642-1234. Jeff, when you look more broadly at the company, is any production done outside the U.S., and how do you make that decision?
Well, we do import some product. If we need to hit a certain price point, we do some public safety footwear for law enforcement, security, and, you know, that is a very price-sensitive market. And so we partner with some overseas manufacturers to hit those price points. But we are, you know, our mix is almost 80% that we make, that we sell are made in the United States. So overwhelmingly, our product is made in the United States.
As you mentioned, last year, Weinbrenner Shoe Company celebrates its, you know, 130th anniversary. Factory in Marshfield listed in the state and national registers of historic places. How much is this factory still in operation?
Well, we have three factories in the state of Wisconsin. We've got two here in Merrill and one in Marshfield. And the factory in Marshfield was built in 1935. And it's still functioning. We still utilize the factory.
Do you find that you have to make updates to the factory to adjust to what the needs of a footwear company is like today?
Yeah, interesting that you say that. We have had kind of a challenge the last few years. The demand for the product was greater than our ability to produce. So we worked with the city of Merrill here, and we moved into a 142,000 square foot facility. That was a new facility for us, and it allowed us to become more efficient and allowed us to produce more product that would allow us to meet the increased demand for the brand.
So as more people tend to buy shoes online rather than in brick-and-mortar retail stores, how does Thorogood adapt its business?
Well, you know, we've got a lot of good brick and mortar dealers that we support across the country. And, you know, there's still a lot of people that want to go into a store and try on a boot, but you're right. There's been a huge increase in online purchases. And, you know, we sell to a lot of the big, internet companies. You know, you can find our boots up on Amazon. And, you know, we support both our e-commerce dealers and our brick and mortar dealers.
Jeff Burns is president of Weinbrenner Shoe Company. Its brand of work boots, Thorogood, made the finals in this year's Coolest Thing Made in Wisconsin competition. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. With roots as a small cobbler in Milwaukee over 130 years ago, we explore the Weinbrenner Shoe Company with its president, Jeff Burns. The Merrill-based boot manufacturer makes the brand Thorogood a finalist in this year's Coolest Thing Made in Wisconsin contest. Call in with a question. Share your perspectives. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. your website says Thorogood is employee owned. Can you explain your business structure?
Yes. We were owned by a large international company back in the 80s, and they actually were going to shut down these factories, and we were going to be another statistic in the the loss of American shoemaking. And a local group of businessmen bought the company away from the international company and saved everybody's jobs in these factories. And then in 2000, the businessmen sold it to the employees. And so, yeah, we since 2000, we're an employee-owned company. And we take great pride in that we are employee owners of this wonderful company.
What is the role of unionization?
When we did go to employee-owned, we are a union factory. As a matter of fact, we've been a union factory since 1947. And again, we're proud of the fact that we are union-made. When we went to an ESOP employee-owned company, the union chose not to become part of the ESOP, and we match a 401k for our union people. But our union people, even though they're not part of the employee-owned structure, they're still part of the Weinbrenner family. And again, they take great pride in making the best boots in the world.
As the leader, do you see advantages of operating a business in this way?
Well, I think, again, you need people who take pride in making boots, because like I said before, if just because you're made in the USA doesn't mean that people are going to support you. You've got to make a great product, and we do. And because we're made in the USA, the people can, again, wear our boots with pride. And we, again, get comments from all over the world saying that they think that we're the finest boots in the world.
Next door in Minnesota, there is Red Wing Shoes. I'm just wondering, how do you handle the competition?
Well, we think Red Wing is a great company, and they've been in business not quite as long as we have, but they've been in business a long time. They're a good company, and it's good competition. And we support American manufacturing. And when we hear of another company that's gone out of business, it pains us, because we don't want to see the American shoe industry dry up. But our competition is healthy, and we feel like if we make the best boots in the world, and we put a lot of pride into what we make, that we're going to be supported by the people who buy our boots. And the thing that's nice about our customers is they come back year after year and buy our boots. So we're doing something right.
I wonder, how is it that competition is healthy for you? What makes good competition? Is that because you have to keep updating and advancing your product? Like, how can you explain that a little bit further?
Yeah, I mean, certainly, there's competition at retail level, and if your competition is advancing and bringing out product that's got a lot of technology, then it keeps us on our toes too. And we've got to go back to the drawing board and make sure that we develop the product that is going to be state of the art, that's going to be best in class. And you're right. Having competition kind of keeps you on your toes that way, because you want to compete, and you want to put the best product out there. And if there's people making good product, you want to make better product.
Let's bring on a caller, Eugene and Viola. Eugene, hi.
Good morning. I run a shoe shine stand, a special event, 1880 shoe shine stand, a special event from Civil War reenactments during the summer months, and I probably polish some of your shoes. And to do so, I use a toothbrush to make sure I get in on the threads, to preserve those threads. And the polish I use is an Angelus out of California, probably about the best on the market, more or less. But you see, people will take care of their boots, and if they take care of them, they'll last them a long time.
Eugene, thank you so much for the call. Jeff, what is the best way to care for boots?
Well, like the gentleman just said, a boot is a skin. I mean, it's a natural material, And if you keep moisture in the skins, they'll last longer. If you don't keep a polish on your footwear, you can have a tendency to dry out the leather, and then that's when the leather cracks. And he's spot on when he says, if you take care of your boots, they'll last a lot longer. So that's keeping a good polish on it, keeping good mink oil on it, and keeping that leather soft and supple.
This time of year, hunters are going out in the fields. As you talk about maintaining the boots, they may come back sopping wet in those boots, going through lots of different terrain. How should you care for them when they've gone through that type of treatment?
Well, if you let them dry out naturally, that's really the best thing for it. Because again, if you try to put it on forced heat or something, then you're going to dry out that leather. So, we recommend the people who are working in our boots buy two pair, and it's not just because we want to sell them two pair, although we do. They rotate the boots, and if you allow your boot to dry out in between usage, they're going to last a lot longer. So it's just maintenance of the boot. So allow your boots to dry out, and they'll last longer for you.
Jeff Burns with us, president of Weinbrenner Shoe Company, talking about Thorogood work boots. You can join in. Question, comments, 800-642-1234. Jeff, what could improve the business climate here in Wisconsin?
Well, I think we've got to address, affordable housing. That's one of the things that we need to really look at here in the state. Our unemployment is very low, and the competition for employees is fierce. And we've had to raise our labor rates considerably over the last couple of years just to compete with other manufacturers and other businesses. But I think that if we could address affordable housing, I think that would go a long way in bringing people to the state, so and they could fill these jobs that are open.
Are you looking for employees who have to move to Wisconsin in order to work in your operations?
Well, again, we've got a lot of great Wisconsin-based people that are artisans. We have looked outside Wisconsin and brought some good shoemakers in. We just brought in a gentleman from Texas that is in charge of our manufacturing that has a lot of experience. But again, the people of Wisconsin, they're hardworking, and they show up every day, and we are very pleased to be here in the state of Wisconsin.
But the
Because
housing
it's a great work
crunch,
ethic.
yeah, the housing crunch to you is a top issue for the state.
I really think so, yeah. I mean, you can bring people in, but if you can't find affordable housing, it's pretty tough.
How are you incorporating environmentally sustainable practices into your boot manufacturing? What are your thoughts there?
Well, we're looking at, there's a lot of issues going on with PFAS now and that chemical. So we've gone and looked at it for years at becoming as clean as we could be in the components that we make. Our business is considered a clean business, and we're not a dirty manufacturer that produces chemicals and things. And so we've really put a lot of energy and effort on sustainability and recycling where we could, and using materials that are good for the environment.
What about the waterproofing agents for your boots? Because PFAS have been used there in the past.
Yeah, and again, we've been working with our manufacturers, our component people, to get and reduce that. I think the last time I looked, I think we've reduced our PFAS use by over 90%. So we're working with our distributors, our component manufacturers, to reduce those harmful chemicals. And it's not easy because a lot of these chemicals have been used for a lot of years, but there's a lot of awareness now. And again, we're working with companies that can provide us clean components.
We have about 20 seconds left. Quick question from John in Milwaukee. Wonders if Thorogood boots can be sold. Soled, I think.
Probably resold.
Resold, resold. Asking. Yes, resold.
Yeah, absolutely. That's another benefit to our product. Our boots are cemented and stitched on, and you can take it to a shoe repair shop and they can put a new sole on it. So the components that we use are such good quality that a lot of people wear out the outsole before they wear out the boot, and they put a new sole on it and they get another year or two worth of wear out of them.
Oh, Jeff, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you guys having me this morning. It was very, very informative.
Jeff Burns, president of Weinbrenner Shoe Company. Brand of work boots is thorough good. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Our days begin with our fingers doing a tap-tap here and there and a flick on a switch. How many buttons, keys, and switches do you think our fingertips touch? Call in with a question, share comments about switches that may be, second nature to us. The number is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Jason Pushkar is a professor of literature at UW-Milwaukee. New book, it's called The Switch, an off and on history of digital humans. Jason, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, so your research included counting how many times a day you pushed a button or flipped a switch, hit a key. What did you learn?
Well, I learned it was a lot more than I expected. That was way at the beginning of this when I wondered, could this possibly be a book or not? And I thought, well, I'd better count and just see how many switches I push. And I think the first sign of trouble was I couldn't figure out how to do it without recording keystroke logging spyware on my computer and having a button-based clicker counter, the kind that ticket takers have at the door. And in the course of a full day of work and email and everything from the kitchen appliances to the dashboard of the car, it came out to almost 30,000 different switches and buttons. And so it was at that point that I thought, if you do anything 30,000 times a day, you better really think hard about what it is that you're doing. You better think about what it's doing back to you.
Yes, indeed. And so talk a little bit about, the history of the word switch and what you learned about what we do when we flip on a light.
Sure. When the first things that kind of look like electrical switches crop up in the early 1800s, they're almost exclusively connected to telegraph machinery. And so the input key of a Morse Veil telegraph is pretty close to the first electrical switch, though not the first switch. But for many decades, the word switch doesn't exist yet. And so when you read patents from the mid-19th century, early electrical machinery, that refers to the thing to turn it off and on as, say, an automatic circuit opening and closing device. So they needed something a little bit more congenial than that. The word switch really got borrowed from railroad switch tracks, because a railroad switch track was something that has only two functional positions. You can go straight or you can turn off. And so it seemed to be a kind of analogy for the way a switch works, with one of two options, on or off. But even the railroad switch track was developed by analogy from a switch, a kind of curved piece of a stick or something that you might use for beating something. And it's named after the curved rail that seems to lash against the fixed rail, sliding back and forth. So by degrees, we developed this terminology of switching. And, by the 20th century, people started to talk about switching careers or switching trains. And to use that as a synonym for human change, we kind of forget that we're using a machine analogy or a machine metaphor when we say we're going to switch careers or switch trains. But actually we are, and we can watch that develop pretty quickly through the 1800s.
And it's also about choice. You have this line, switches transform change into choice. Can you explain the human agency here in switches?
Yeah, I really think about it in terms of choices being belonging to individuals. And I think one of the things that switches do really powerfully is help us feel our individuality. our autonomy, our responsibility, our separateness, our independence. But to be an individual, to be freestanding in that way, your actions actually have to be individuated too. And, you know, out in the real world in everyday life, I think it's true that almost all of the time, actions kind of blend into each other. It's really hard to find hard starting and stopping points in nature for action. Something happened, it influenced this next thing, that influenced something else. It all gets kind of mixed up together. And if you want to sort those out, say at a trial, you're going to need a lot of lawyers and a lot of money to do it. But maybe an easier way is to invent some little machines that create really evident starting and stopping points in the flow of actions so that actions don't seem to get mixed up with each other. So when I push a switch to turn on a light, there can't really be a huge debate that I did or did not turn on the light. There's only one way to turn it on. It didn't turn on by itself. And you can't really see any other part of the process that's involved, right? Mm-hmm. I turned on the light.
Mm-hmm.
I sometimes think about heating my home that way. I walk up to the thermostat and I touch a little button. Up goes the temperature by a degree. But you know, 200 years ago, I would have had to be stacking wood, chopping wood. Somebody would have cut the tree down, brought it to the house. Someone had to dry it. Someone else probably brought it in. Heating the house would have been this big team effort. And all that labor was visible. You could just see it. But now when I heat the home, I push a button and I don't see any of it. There's still a fire. And there's still resources that are burning somewhere down at the power plant. But the switch has helped me forget about that so I can more easily experience the results as belonging just to me.
You also examine how children are enthralled by elevator buttons. As buttons have become more high-tech and digital, so easy just to touch and be gone, how are kids interacting with buttons differently?
Well, I think that might have been the real source of this project. Kids are older now, but, you know, when they were young, I think, I noticed just how enthralled they were by buttons. And the elevator button was a big one. They would have murdered each other to be the first one to push the elevator button. And I think, I do remember thinking, what is the big deal? The switches are kind of boring. They do the same thing every time. They don't move very much. There's just not a lot going on. So what's the thrill? And, I think a lot of this book actually does try to think about switching from the child's perspective and to try to figure out what have we retained as adults from that. And, I kind of came to the conclusion that if you think about pushing an elevator button from the perspective of a child can do so little powerfully or well. They can't write, they can't drive, they can't do any of the things they envy their parents doing. And the one thing they're really good at, destroying things, we don't let them do. So, what a predicament. And then here's this little button on the wall. They can walk up to it, and with no effort, they touch it, and a magic room appears. The whole family gets in, it vibrates a little, and you're in a different place. And for a child, it must be like getting on the Star Trek transporter. And they did that in the same way that me pushing the thermostat feels like I did all that because I can forget about everything else that assisted in the process. And, I think that kind of the magic of switching, the apparent magic of switching is so alive and evident in children. And that helped me a lot in this book to figure out how it maybe persists even for adults.
That little tiny index finger pushing that elevator button, giving them that little bit of power and authority in the moment. Jason Pushkar, professor of literature at UW-Milwaukee, new book called The Switch. You can join in with your questions and comments along the way, 800-642-1234. Jason, you write about the prevalence of the QWERTY keyboard and go deep into that history and the kinship to the musical instrument. How are musical and typing keyboards similar?
Well, this is a great year to talk about this because this happens to be the 150th anniversary of the QWERTY keyboard. And it is undoubtedly Wisconsin's most famous invention and most famous export to the whole world, much bigger than beer, if that's possible.
Wow.
The whole world types on QWERTY keyboards, and they were invented here in Milwaukee around 1873, and they were on sale by 1874. So this month, actually, November of 1873 was when they went into production and started rolling off assembly lines. And so, the keyboard developed kind of gradually out of musical instruments and interfaces that looked a lot like piano keyboards. So for the mid-19th through the mid-19th century, plenty of people were trying to invent personal writing machines. They didn't call anything a typewriter just yet. And the vast majority of those actually had little tiny keyboards that looked like toy pianos. And one of the reasons they had that was that they were all imitating another machine that wasn't a prototype and wasn't experimental, and that was the what's called the printing telegraph. And those were kinds of telegraphs that were actually very popular. We never see them in movies about the 19th century, but they were all over and especially popular in Europe, though they were American inventions. And these were basically teletypes. You typed at one end, and the other end, without any Morse code, your message came out on a little paper tape. So they were really amazing, amazing inventions for the time. And the first ones were invented in the 1840s, just a couple years after the Morse Veil telegraph system that we're all more familiar with. And they had the white and black keys alternating. They weren't arranged in octaves, but they had the letters A through about the middle of the alphabet went from left to right on the black keys. And then from right to left, the second half of the alphabet wrapped around the other way and came back from right to left on the white keys. And if you look at your QWERTY keyboard today, even though we've changed the form of it, there's a lot that survives from that arrangement. So if you go left to right on black and right to left on white, A and Z are on top of each other, and they still are today.
That's what I just find so remarkable in your writing is that the keyboard that we're typing on today has remained remarkably the same over 150 years. How can that be?
I have no idea. I think it, it'd be like if we were riding around on bicycles with 4 foot wide big front wheels. And yet we don't do that. We found better bicycles. We don't crank our phones and talk into a horn sticking out of the wall. We don't, we've changed all those Victorian technologies, good as they were. We found different ways to do it. And yet the QWERTY keyboard is this bug in amber preserved from the past. And I think that's really remarkable. I guess if I have to try to explain it, I would say that, I think we make a mistake if we try to think about this in utilitarian terms, as if it is or it isn't the most efficient tool for the job and that that has something to do with its survival. I think probably the reason we stick with it is that we like it on aesthetic grounds, that it's beautiful, it's familiar, it's comfortable, and maybe it's more like fashion in that way. Why do men wear neckties? There's no utilitarian explanation for why I wear a necktie, and my father wore a necktie, and his father wore a necktie, and his father wore a necktie. Somehow we started wearing neckties, and we passed it down from generation to generation, and it seems natural and right to do. And I think that that's kind of what the QWERTY keyboard is. Ironically enough, the fact that it's just a kind of piece of fashion means that it should be the most easy to change, but in fact, like neckties, it actually makes it the most resistant to change.
The book is called The Swish, Switch, Jason Pushkar, UW Milwaukee English professor, tracing the history of buttons and keys, how they interact with our lives. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Switches, keys, and buttons, they are part of everyday life and have proliferated massively and continuously in almost every area of life. That's according to UW Milwaukee English professor Jason Pushkar, whose new book, it's called The Switch. Be part of this discussion. Call in with a question. Share comments. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Randy in Ripon is here. Hi, Randy. What would you like to bring up?
Hi. Well, you guys kind of covered the typewriter keyboard layout, which today I still don't understand why we just don't do it logically, but you kind of answered that. But I'm 67 years old, and I remember the old dial phones. And now that I have cell phones and all that, the other thing I find frustrating is my construction big clumsy fingers. I'm always hitting adjacent keys on the keyboard, and I wish they would make things a little bit bigger, spaced out or something with these keyboards. Anyways, that's my comment.
Randy, thank you so much for that contribution. Jason, go ahead.
I'm with you, Randy. I think that a lot of the switches we use, you know, they kind of masquerade as conveniences, but honestly, they interject all these incredible inconveniences. Maybe we get back the thrill of the power that I described with kids at the elevator, but they introduce all kinds of frustrations as well. And there are interfaces. You mentioned the dial telephone that, you know, also worked really well. I'm old enough to remember the dial telephones, and I remember an early stage when they switched over from dial rotary telephones to buttons, but the buttons didn't beep yet. They made a kind of click, 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 click noise to, you know, to imitate the dial. And it was just murder to use those things. And yet somehow we thought it must be worth it. I have a chapter in this book, too, about calculating machines and how hard people had to work in the late 19th century to make primitive mechanical calculating machines work with keys. They actually had really good ones that worked with dials and slides already. Why did they have to have buttons and keys? It made it so much harder to do. And eventually they got there, but it took decades and decades of hard work to do it. And it was never really clear why. So, yeah, Randy, I sympathize completely with the inutility of so many buttons in our world today.
And you point out that the keyboards of basically the same size and shape and arrangement, that they're used around the world. What is like the global keyboard culture? I mean, are there people around the world who feel the same way Randy does?
I would imagine that they do. I mean, you know, and keyboard culture, I'm thinking about the QWERTY arrangement, for instance, and the way in which we've all kind of taken for granted that's how you write these days. And that's true even in Asian languages with very different ways of writing. Asian languages tend to use QWERTY keyboards with Roman letters on them. You type a few things in, and then a kind of algorithmic search function starts trying to find the right Asian language character, and you select it as it presents you with a menu of autofill options. And so there's really no escaping it. You know, even in languages that don't use the arrangement of Roman letters, like Greek or Russian, we still actually have the same basic shape with the staggered rows of keys, a row of numbers, three rows of letters, a space bar at the bottom. The consistency and the stability of that arrangement across so many societies and so many different languages is just really stunning to me.
You say that buttons have the potential to distance people from one another. How do buttons affect people's sense of individuality?
Well, I think they confirm it and augment it. I think of the world that we've made and that we've covered with switches is functioning a little bit like a mirror that reflects back an image of ourselves at twice its normal size. We feel so much more powerful and capable than we would otherwise. I think of them sometimes kind of like assistive technologies or prosthetics. I'm wearing glasses right now. I have titanium screws in my right knee. I have a mouthful of dental fillings. And without these cyborg add-ons, you know, I couldn't move around very well. I wouldn't be able to read. I wouldn't be able to eat normal food. They help me mechanically feel like a natural, able-bodied person, but I'm very machine dependent for that. And I think that switches kind of do something else, not with fillings in my mouth or screws holding together my knee, but really all around me. What they hold together is my conception of myself as somebody who's autonomous, capable, free, who can will an action and bring it about almost effortlessly. And that's hard to do in the rest of the world.
Jason Pushkar with us, professor of literature at UW-Milwaukee. New book is called The Switch. You can join in with your questions and comments at 800-642-1234. Jason, I want to bring up voting machines. You describe how voting machines mechanize democratic procedures. How does the use of buttons affect politics?
Well, the history of voting machines is obviously something a lot of people are interested in now because there's such an issue of trust with them. And that goes back to the very beginning. The first voting machines in the US were used in Rochester, New York in around 1893. And then they were used in 1896 in a presidential election with disastrous results. And this first voting machine didn't look much like ours. It was a 7-foot square iron room closed on all sides with a double door. You went into this safe. One wall is covered with buttons, each one with a candidate name. You push these big buttons in, and the idea was that it would tabulate the choice of the voter and mechanically record all this, and you just sum it up at the end. The problem was it didn't work very well, counts were off, and so on. But the goal here was really to safeguard the privacy and the secrecy of the ballot so that people couldn't be coerced or bribed into voting anything other than their conscience. But I kind of love the model of this first voting machine, which shows you the cost of that, which is, not only do you have the individualizing effect of the button, but you have the isolating effect of this iron room that you get locked inside in order to be a democratic subject, a democratic agent. And that's really different. An early English election in the 1800s would have been a raucous public affair, lots of singing, dancing on the green. But it was public, and your vote was public as well. So the cost of that individualized privacy that accomplished by both the button and the enclosure in the voting booth was a kind of isolation as well.
In our final moments together, where will the next stages of switching lead? What do you envision?
I don't envision that it's going to go anywhere anytime soon. People are always predicting that we'll have something better, voice control or thought control. But I think people actually really like to control their world with their fingers. And I think we have a whole culture that really is finger-based, and that voice control or even some kind of thought control, which people are experimenting with, I think that those are in some ways less satisfying than using our fingers. We learned to do that over many decades. They're still comparatively recently. I saw a story the other day in the New York Times about a new personal assistant called the AI pin. It's a little lapel pin. It clips on your shirt.
Right next to the necktie.
Right next to the necktie, exactly. And when you t it can talk to you, but it can also project a little interface onto your hand, and you can control it by just touching your fingers. So your own fingers become the switches or the buttons. You touch one finger to this finger, and something happens. This to this one, another one happens. So the body itself can be turned into a switch too.
To be continued. Jason, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Jason Pushkar, professor of literature, UW-Milwaukee. New book is called The Switch, an off and on history of digital humans. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.